Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about a man who used to fly straight at the biggest mountain in North America. Aim for a slope of blue ice tilted up like the side of a barn roof and set a little airplane down on it going uphill, so the grade would stop him, on purpose, in weather that would keep most of us tied down at the ramp drinking coffee. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Taildragger, and this is the hangar where we sit a spell and talk about the people who made flying what it is. Today we are going up onto Denali, the mountain the old maps called McKinley, 20,310 feet of rock and ice sticking up out of the Alaska Range. And we are going up there with a bush pilot named Don Sheldon. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and I'll tell you, if there was ever a man whose whole life was a coin worth carrying in your pocket, it's the fellow we're talking about today. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, Talkeetna, Alaska. If you've never been, picture a little frontier town at the end of a spur road, sitting where three rivers come together, the Susitna, the Tulitna, and the Talkeetna, dirt streets, a few log buildings. And on a clear morning, if you walk to the end of the main street and look north, the whole Alaska Range fills up the sky and Denali stands over all of it like it owns the place. Because it does. That's where Don Sheldon set up shop after the Second World War. He'd come up to Alaska as a young man, worked on the railroad, and caught the flying bug the way a lot of them did back then. Watching other men do the impossible and figuring he could learn it too, he got his ticket. He bought into a little air service, and he started doing what Talkeetna bush pilots did, hauling trappers and prospectors and hunters out into country with no roads, landing on gravel bars and tundra and frozen lakes, bending airplanes now and then and fixing them with baling wire and stubbornness. But Sheldon looked up at that mountain, and where the rest of the world saw a wall, he saw a set of runways nobody had used yet. Now here's where it gets interesting. Landing an airplane on a glacier is not like landing anywhere else, and I want you to understand why. Because it's the heart of the whole story. When you come down toward a snowfield high on a mountain, you lose your depth perception. Everything is white. There's no tree, no fence post, no shadow to tell you how high you are or how fast that surface is coming up. Pilots have flown perfectly good airplanes right into a glacier at cruise because their eyes told them they still had 100 feet when they had 6. And the snow itself lies to you. Underneath a smooth white blanket, there can be a crevasse deep enough to swallow a house. There can be a hidden ridge of ice that'll flip you. The surface can be soft sugar, snow that grabs a ski and stands the airplane on its nose, or it can be glare ice as slick as a skating rink. And the grade, a glacier landing area, isn't flat, it runs uphill, sometimes steeply. So Sheldon worked out a technique that sounds backwards until you think about it. He'd land going uphill, on purpose, and let the slope of the mountain do the braking for him. And then when it was time to leave, he'd take off going downhill, pointed out into 1,000 feet of empty air, and just fall off the edge of the glacier until the wings started flying. Uphill to stop, downhill to go. The mountain was the runway and gravity was the throttle. He flew a Piper Super Cub, mostly. Later an Aeronca, other airplanes too. But the Cub is the one that lives in the legend. Little tandem two-seater, fabric skin, a small engine up front, and skis where the wheels would be, slow. And slow up there is exactly what you want. A Super Cub will practically hover into a headwind coming off a ridge. Sheldon rigged his with everything he needed to survive, if the weather closed the door behind him, because up on that mountain the weather does not care about your schedule. Let me put you in that cockpit for a minute. It's cold, the kind of cold that comes right through fur and wool and gets into your teeth. The little engine is hammering away out front, and the whole airframe is buzzing with it, and the wind is coming down off the summit in waves you can feel in the stick. Sheldon's flying up a glacier, the Ruth Glacier maybe, into a gorge with granite walls, a mile high standing up on both sides of him, close enough that it feels like he could reach out and drag a wingtip along the rock. There's no going back once he commits. The canyon's too narrow to turn around in. He has to fly it all the way to the top, find a spot, and put her down. And he'd read that snow like you and I read a taxiway. He'd fly low passes first, dragging the surface, watching how the light played across it, looking for the shadow of a crevasse, feeling the airplane sometimes. He'd drop a spruce bough or a marker out the window on a low pass, and then come back around and use it as a depth cue, something dark against all that white so his eyes had something to grab onto. Then he'd bring her around one more time, ease off the power, and let the uphill snow rise up and take the skis, and the little cub would groan to a stop on the side of a mountain where no wheel had ever rolled. That took a kind of nerve most of us will never be asked to find.
Now, why did he do it? Money was part of it. Sure, a man's got to eat. But the real reason Don Sheldon's name still gets said with respect in Talkeetna is the rescues. When something went wrong high on Denali, and on a mountain like that something always eventually goes wrong, there was exactly one man in the whole territory who could fly up there and get you, climbers with broken legs. Parties pinned down by storms above 18,000 feet with their food gone and frostbite setting in. Fellas who'd fallen into crevasses, when the call came, and it usually came at the worst possible time and the worst possible weather, Sheldon went. 1960. There's a mountaineering expedition on the mountain, and it goes bad in the way these things do, all at once. A climber named John Day and his party take a fall high up, tumbling down a slope, badly hurt, and roped up nearby by pure chance are two of the most famous mountaineers in the world at that moment, a pair who had just made a hard first ascent on another part of the mountain, everybody stranded up around the 17,000-foot mark, broken bones, no way down under their own power, and a storm sitting on them, 17,000 feet, now understand, that is thin, thin air. The little engine on a Super Cub is gasping up there, the wings barely bite, everything the airplane can do is cut down to a fraction. Most pilots will tell you flat out that you cannot land and take off from that altitude on that mountain in a light airplane. It's too high, the air's too thin, you won't have the power to get off again. Sheldon did it anyway. He flew up into that gorge, up above 17,000 feet, onto a little shelf of snow, and he brought them down off the mountain one and two at a time, trip after trip, threading that canyon in weather that kept opening and slamming shut. He'd land, load a hurt man into that tiny cabin, fall off the edge of the glacier to get his flying speed back, thread the granite walls back down the gorge, land at a lower camp, unload, and turn right around and climb back up for the next one.
He didn't do it once. He did it as many times as it took. And the men he carried down that day walked out of it alive because one bush pilot decided that the word impossible was somebody else's problem. And that was not the only time. Over the years, Sheldon pulled climbers and hunters and downed flyers and stranded parties out of that country over and over. He found people nobody expected to find alive. He airdropped supplies to expeditions in howling wind, flying passes so precise the bundle would land right in camp. There's a story of him spotting a swamped boat full of soldiers in a flooded river, unable to land, so he flew back to town and then flew back out and dropped them an inflatable raft, circling and circling in the storm until every one of those men was safe. When people were in trouble in the Alaska Range, the sound they prayed to hear was the buzz of Don Sheldon's Cub coming up the valley. Now here's a thing I love about him. He didn't think he was a daredevil, he thought he was careful. And in his own way he was. Every one of those wild landings was built on top of 10,000 hours of reading snow and reading weather, and reading his airplane. He knew exactly what that Super Cub could do because he'd found the edge of it 100 times in country where nobody was watching. He wasn't gambling, he was cashing in a lifetime of homework. There's a lesson in there for every one of us, whether we ever see a glacier or not. The pilot who looks fearless up close is usually just the pilot who did the most preparation nobody saw. He built a little hexagonal cabin out on the Ruth Glacier, right in the middle of that amphitheater of granite and ice, a place people now call the Don Sheldon Mountain House. Think about that. A man who loved a place so much, a place that hostile and that beautiful, that he built himself a home on the ice in the middle of it, so he could sit and look at the mountain that had been trying to kill him for 30 years. That tells you everything about the breed.
Don Sheldon flew that country until cancer took him in 1975. He was only in his late 50s, but by the time he was gone, he'd more or less written the book on mountain flying and glacier landings, the book that the Talkeetna air taxi outfits still fly by today. Every time a modern ski plane sets a load of climbers down at the 14,000-foot base camp on the Kahiltna Glacier so they can go have their crack at the summit, they are flying a road that Don Sheldon scouted out first, alone, in a fabric airplane with nobody to call for help if it went wrong. Back when Avegas was cheap and airspace was free, there were a lot of good bush pilots in Alaska. Tough men, skilled men. But there was only one who looked at the tallest mountain on the continent and decided it was a place he could land. And the reason we still say his name is not that he was reckless, it's that he was there. Every single time somebody up on that ice needed a miracle, and he brought the miracle himself in a two-seat Piper Cub. I owe today's story to Don Sheldon's own account of his life, in the book The Wager with the Wind by James Greiner, and to the folks in Talkeetna and the National Park Service who still keep his memory and is flying alive on that mountain. If you want to see more of these stories, we keep them over at RadioHanger.com. Next time you're grumbling about a little crosswind on a paved runway, and Lord knows I do it too, think about a man landing uphill on a glacier at 17,000 feet to carry a stranger home. Puts it in perspective, doesn't it?
This is Tail Dragger. Keep your airspeed up and your stories close. I'll see you back here in the hangar.